Hi, everyone, and welcome to First State Insights, a podcast presented by the University of Delaware's Institute for Public Administration. That's IPA for short. My name is Troy Mix. I'm Associate Director at IPA and your host for this episode. I'm joined today by Tim Schaefer. He's the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Chair of Civil Discourse at the University of Delaware's Biden School of Public Policy and Administration. Tim leads the SNF Ithaca Initiative at the Biden School. Established in fall 2021 with a generous grant from the Stavros Niarchos Foundation, the SNF Ithaca Initiative aims to increase the quality and quantity of civil discourse and civic engagement by instilling core democratic values on UD's campus and beyond. During our conversation on January 25th, 2023, Tim and I discussed the history, dimensions, and future of engaged universities in the United States. Topics covered along the way include the development of the land-grant university system in the U.S., the need for universities to foster democratic citizenship, and the efforts Tim and colleagues at the Biden School are leading to make students engaged and effective citizens. Let's get to the conversation. Well, thanks, Tim, for joining me today.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
This is the first episode of 2023 for us, and it's also the first episode of our 50th anniversary year. So IPA got rolling in 1973. And we like to think of ourselves as part of this tradition that involves land-grant universities. And it's kind of a tradition that thinks of universities as having an engagement mission, having a public service mission. And folks like you and I are steeped in that on a day-to-day basis in different ways. You know, coming from economic development and planning background, I think of it as, you know, helping farmers to experiment with crop practices and helping communities that those farmers make up, for example, to having research parks and intellectual property that helps the regional and global marketplace over a span of 160 years, I guess now we've been doing this land grant thing. It's a little easy to get lost, though, I think, in terms of not really being able to articulate what this mission is, and came home for me at last night when my son, 10-year-old son, asked, why do universities have a public service mission? And probably a 20-minute response to him was not the right calibration of like an answer. So I guess, you know, if you could explain to me, like I'm a 10-year-old, why do universities do engagement in public service?
Well, I think that's an amazing question that your 10-year-old asked. It's one I think that deserves rightfully more attention, not just in a moment when we're asking fundamental questions of like, what are we investing in as society, right? Where do we put resources as states, as countries, right? All this sort of thing. Universities, particularly public universities, and for us, especially land-grant universities, and I hope we can kind of unpack what that language really means, is that in a kind of deeply rooted way, democratic life is fostered and made possible through an engaged and thoughtful citizenry. We educate, we help kind of create conditions for that learning. And I think fundamentally for us, when we think about land-grant universities, the sense of kind of service, and I'd say the broader language that often is included now is this kind of engagement, collaboration, touches on the things that you're talking about, right? Some of this is really technical. It's about creating outlets for people to share their research, to inform practice, right? One of the formative essays for me when I was a doctoral student was from the USDA, this yearbook. And in 1940, it was called Farmers in a Changing World. This huge volume that's like more than 1,000 pages. One of the chapters in there was written by this guy named M.L. Wilson, who was an agricultural economist. Later, he becomes director of extension. At that time, he was an assistant, then undersecretary of agriculture in the USDA. But he was the one who was behind this kind of discussion movement in the 1930s and 40s through extension to say, we need to look at opportunities to serve communities, to engage them, to help them talk and think about their collective issues. But as an agricultural economist, his chapter was called Beyond Economics. And he literally said, you know, he's talking about the agricultural problem, right? Which was this broad kind of category. But he said, you know, whoever studies social economic aspects of agriculture as they're kind of presented, right, in this whole big volume, that we're missing out. They must be convinced that there's a problem of adjustment in agriculture and rural life. It's not simple and cannot be solved by simple means. Even the major questions are numerous. And he goes on to say, like, whenever we think about these questions, it needs to include all these other kind of layers. And the reason I say that, and this goes a little bit more of the work that I do specifically research wise, but when we think about these institutions and we think about service and its purpose, it's rooted in this idea that universities, because of their composition, aren't kind of narrowly focused or myopic. People have research agendas or areas of expertise, but if we can think about them as larger systems, and IPA is a great one, right? When we think about this, you can have people who are in planning. You can have people who are in development. You can have, oh, hey, we need to be talking, if we're talking about a particular natural resource, how do we engage with some of the people who are maybe in a different department or a unit on campus that can be really complementary and help thinking about this? Or when we're talking about rising water, right? Coastal communities, right? What do we do with that, right? And so when we think about the kind of mission and purpose of universities, I wouldn't have said all that to a 10-year-old. They would have probably fallen asleep if it was a bedtime story at that moment. But I think the short version is education plays an essential role in democracy, right? We need to learn. We need to be not just introduced to concepts and ideas and know how to do equations and all this sort of stuff. But we fundamentally need to learn how to become citizens. Then we take that next step to higher education. It's that same kind of wrestling, the technical knowledge and expertise with this larger sense of purpose. What is our public purpose? And service then fits right into that, right? Because if we want to think about knowledge creation, you don't just do it and then like kind of bundle it up and kind of keep it to yourself. There really is this kind of outward orientation. And there have been in recent decades, this real call and invitation for higher ed. You know, there's a number of these that sit on my shelves titled things like Higher Education for the Public Good. There's another one called To Serve a Larger Purpose, right? These sorts of conversations are happening, but it's, you know, I think an opportunity for both those inside of these places and beyond to understand that this is even a thing that's going on, right? Because I think it's easy to have it kind of be under the radar. And I think, unfortunately, whether we're talking about parents who are looking at sending their children to universities, we're talking about state legislators who are trying to figure out how much money to allocate to these institutions in their states, all that sort of stuff.
I want to come back to a lot of those threads, I think, as we're talking here. And I want to go back to biography or maybe how you thought about these things growing up. I know when I was growing up and I was in New York State, upstate New York, and I didn't relate to a lot of universities, but Cornell Cooperative Extension was seemingly around every corner. You could find some of their programs or some buildings. And my dad was very interested in me going to Cornell because it's, of course, it's in the Ivy League. But he also made the point that, oh, if you go to their labor relations school, it's a state tuition situation. So there was this knowledge that there was this grand place you could go to in the Ivy League, but related to this mission of public service again. I'm interested for you, when did you start to understand that there was this different mission for universities out there? And when did it kind of start to appeal to you?
Yeah, so that's a fascinating question. And go Cornell. I did my PhD at Cornell, and in large part because of this. So I grew up in Southern Ohio, kind of rural Appalachia. My father never completed higher education. He spent his professional career as a police officer. My mom was a nurse, went to Ohio State, the land grant, the Ohio State, I should say, so we don't get in trouble. She was a farm kid, and they talked about doing 4-H all the time on their big front lawn out on Germany Hollow Road, you know, in these kind of rural areas. But we were, you know, I grew up slightly removed from that. I learned to drive my grandpa's tractor, but we weren't directly involved in those sorts of things. We lived a little bit more of the slightly suburban life of scouts and all the sports and all the other things. And when I went off to higher ed and then in subsequent kind of roles, I was really interested in, honestly, and I appreciate your framing this around service, to a small private school actually in Western New York and got really involved in community engaged opportunities. I was a student coordinator at our local soup kitchen and did that a lot, service trips and all this other sort of stuff. And as I went on in my kind of educational career, I found myself, you know, playing roles in centers. I was at the University of Dayton and a place called the Fit Center for Leadership and Community, doing a lot of community partnership sort of work. And this is where I got really introduced to places like the Kettering Foundation and other spots. And so the language, it wasn't just the real practical of like, I'm taking groups of students to look at urban dynamic situations that are going on in, you know, more disadvantaged communities where we were in Dayton, Ohio, for example, but also really getting introduced to this bigger kind of the literature, the scholarship about all this sort of stuff, not just about universities, but about kind of public institutions. And it was really in that moment that I came across the work of a few people, but namely somebody by the name of Scott Peters, who was a professor at Cornell and wrote a lot about both this kind of contemporary question about what does it mean to be these institutions today, but also did a lot of work historically looking at earlier times, particularly in the early 20th century, when cooperative extension, which you referenced, gets established in 1914, this wonderful community-based education, adult education, really, in many ways, and youth education program across the country that has been emulated in many other places around the world. But it was at that moment that I really started to really get into the land grant kind of history and talking about the mission and what it meant and how it was this kind of articulation of higher ed with kind of a public purpose different than others, right? I mean, St. Bonaventure, where I did my undergrad, had a real explicit kind of commitment to things like social justice and community because it was a Catholic, a Franciscan school, right? And so there was a certain kind of ethos, a culture to that place. And I think in those environments, it's easy to lean into that sort of identity. Sometimes for public institutions, it's harder because we don't have either the language or this kind of, you know, reference point to, you know, some 12th century saint who was, for good or bad, seen with the bird feeder sort of stuff, like loving all the animals. But when I really got introduced to the kind of the land grant history and the mission, I was just so intrigued and really interested. So I ended up going to Cornell to work with Scott Peters and get really interested in this, where it intersects with a lot of the work I do now around kind of dialogue and deliberation, public engagement. How do we think about these institutions through things like extension, but not exclusively? How do they engage their communities, the publics, not just public, right? So we're not creating some big universe of everybody, but like distinct communities and places, people and things like that. And so I went off to work on a big project. We published a book a few years ago called Jumping Into Civic Life, which is these practitioner profiles, these stories of academics doing really meaningful work around this, which is for me, one of the wonderful opportunities I had in that project was to like really speak with, visit with, talk with these people all the time. But what happened, and I referenced it a little bit ago with the Beyond Economics chapter from that USDA yearbook, is that I knew there were these kind of roots in this work. And when I started to dig more deeply into that, I was struck by how there was this narrative that was not really well known. We didn't know, I think, some of these interesting chapters and moments that in 1942, actually somebody, a professor at Iowa State, his name is Earl Ross, wrote a book called Democracy's College, right? Second half of that title was The Land Grant Movement in the Formative Stage. So he's writing about the early periods, you know, land grants starting in the 1860s, 1862, and 1890s, historically Black institutions, the Second Morrill Act. But becoming more familiar with these earlier moments, and when I think about that in our kind of contemporary experiences, they were thinking up ideas, but they had some rootedness, but they were really trying to imagine what would it look like for higher education to play a really explicit role in and with communities, with places, to everything you were saying earlier, that could help attend to the economic questions, the development questions, the valuing of life, right? Or like, how do we, not just how do we can food, but how do we also like have recreation, right? So one of the beautiful things about a lot of these old documents, they're literally being like, we're literally teaching young girls, and I mean, a lot of this was very gendered at that time, right? Of like how to make clothing, how to make bedding. A lot of it also kind of falling into this line of like how to help your cows not have funky diseases, or what are the spots on your plants. And then literally the next page was about kind of social recreation. Like, so a lot of it was wrapped up in music and community building. And then part of the research, one of the lines of research that I do is what they talked about as community discussions, right? How do they talk about and wrestle with these kind of real challenging issues that at the time that I look at, early 20th century, particularly in the 1930s, really into the 40s, of when places were shifting, right? We were really 1890 was the moment when the U.S. moves from being primarily agricultural to more urban. We start to see, and we read it like literally verbatim, communities are lamenting the fact that their dirt roads are now chip and tar or rocks. Cars are starting to emerge. So no longer are they able to like interact and engage in certain ways. And so they were wrestling with tensions between urban and rural. What does it mean to be a place? What does it mean to have community when all of a sudden those people are flying down the road at probably some, you know, audacious 15 miles an hour or whatever it might have been at the time. But like that sense of the kind of the who we were, to me, it was fascinating to look at that and then also say, how do we then translate some of that from that moment to where we are now?
There is this kind of notion that we come up with the answers in higher ed, and this notion of the ivory tower that's kind of above the fray, which can conflict a little bit with the notion of being engaged with the public, helping the public to figure out the answers for themselves, addressing issues in their communities. And I'd be curious about your insights on like, how do we bridge that potential divide between that notion of searching for the truth, finding the answer, and helping people figure it out on their own?
Oh my gosh, this is such an important thing, right? I mean, I think it's one of the realities that we have to wrestle with in higher ed, right? Fundamentally, we are about education, right? And it's about not just learning more and kind of knowing more, but it's also about creating knowledge. And that's where, you know, land grants are research institutions, which are not simply, this is not to diminish others, but this is where I think research universities play an interesting and distinct role, is that you are teaching, but you're also doing the research that informs that teaching, right? So you're not simply just going somewhere else and pulling something off a shelf, but you're constantly wrestling with that sort of stuff. That's one point there. The related to that then is, yeah, there is, and if we look at the history of land grants, and particularly when we start to formalize these, you know, experiment stations that become in 1887, when they get established, they become these kind of hubs to do, particularly around agriculture. And it kind of broadens a little bit as it goes forward. And then when it gets formalized as a complement to extension in 1914, Smith-Lever Act, right? These sorts of things. A familiar thread to a lot of that was this kind of transfer of knowledge, right? We're going to do the research and we're going to use it as a kind of a dissemination process, right? It was about a transfer of knowledge, right? From the university, we have the experts in the labs and all these sorts of things. And we're going to tell you, right? As I was kind of somewhat joking about earlier, but like, I got a bovine problem. Well, let's talk to the guy who can help us fix that. Or like, there's something funny. I mean, my wife called local extension here when we were trying to figure out, we grow garlic. We knew how to grow garlic in Kansas before we moved here to Delaware. That's where we were. Turns out Delaware has a lot more water and the soil is a lot wetter than Kansas is. So we had to call extension to figure out when's the time to do this, climate, all that sort of stuff. And you know what? There's a person who can tell you some things about that. Why? Because they have some expertise. It's great, right? That's one dimension. And this has always been, I think, at the heart of some of this work too, is that it's not only about that transfer of knowledge, right? There was always this part, and they really wrestled with this. And actually, the most recent book that I editor really kind of gets into these sorts of questions, these early histories, these first few decades, particularly in the 20th century, where they were figuring out, how do we balance between us telling people what to do versus kind of turning it over and being like, you run it and kind of shape it and define it, very grassroots. And then we'll kind of be these outside helpers, but we'll be really hands off. But they in many ways landed somewhere in the middle, right? Of how do we lean into our expertise, but not in such a dominating way that we exclude either local knowledge or experiential knowledge that are informed from, hey, you know what? I've been working this land for 30 years and I can tell you, you know, the times and the places and all this sort of stuff, right? This balance between, you know, technical knowledge and expertise and this willing, and not just a willingness, but a real commitment to engage people for who they are and where they are is really significant. And, you know, I referenced that book, the Jumping into Civic Life book that Scott Peters Ted Alter, who's at Penn State, he's an economist, and I edited a few years ago, and we use that language, right? We talked about there are three different ways to be kind of professionals. One of them is just to stay out of this work, right? Let the communities take care of that. The other one is to like really come in and take over, right? We should name the problems. We frame it. We're going to fix it. And, you know, if you don't have those credentials, just kind of get out of the way. Let us do it. We know best. But this third way is this, you know, as we talk about it there, is, you know, somewhere between. We say it in that book, and I'll read one line from it. Instead of calls for professionals to stay out or take over, the position we're interested in centers on the conditional call that attends to the dynamics of particular contexts and situations. Quote, if it makes sense and is possible, jump in, but be respectful, be humble, and be careful. End quote. The reason I just literally want to read that is that it is a delicate kind of thing, right? We want to recognize, and as I understand it here in Delaware now, as a person who's been here for a bit, is, you know, the University of Delaware plays an outsized role in the state. People know it. It's respected. I think it's a valued partner in lots of ways. And I think we also have to be careful, right? I think how do we not just kind of come in and try to fix the problem without attending to who are the people that are then going to live with that thing that some outsider is going to say you ought to do, right? Because there's going to be lasting effects, whether it's around economic development, it's around how do we respond to climate change, whatever it might be.
Yeah, I know one of the things we like to, I wouldn't say pat ourselves on the back about, but recognize that our value is that we're not going anywhere. So we also have to live with the consequences. If we jump in, try to fix something and fail or leave them with an implementation mess, we're going to have to deal with that in terms of our reputational hit. So we like to think of ourselves as we are players in the region, and players can sound, you know, a bit more grandiose than what we mean, but we show up at the chicken dinner or the legal local government's dinner or the firehouse event. And we are part of the community more than just a hired gun to come in and solve a particular issue. It helps to, you know, make us more of a co-owner of the solutions that they develop and implement over time in these communities. That's the hope, at least.
I think that's a great point. And this real commitment to place, I think that's the beauty. I mean, it's not just simply, you know, something you ship off or call somebody and they fly across the country. I mean, I think to your point is, I think it's a really good one, is that it's not just like, we're going to tell you what to do and I'm going to get on a plane tonight and I'm going to go back across and I'm never going to see you again. So I don't really care. I might be well-intentioned, but it plays differently. If I'm literally living in the place, or if I'm going to show up to the community holiday party or something, they're going to be like, hey, Troy, that thing we were doing not too long ago is a factor. And so this sense of place is huge. And there's another association of kind of state colleges, universities, and they had a great report a few years ago called Stewards of Place. And it was mostly for public regional universities because they were really trying to lean into this. Like, we need to not emulate just some other type of higher education institution. We need to be who we are. And so they really leaned into that sense of place. And I think land grants don't have to be locked into a particular, like, this is our city or this is the region of the state, but it really is the state, right? This is the, you know, the Wisconsin idea really emerges as an articulation. University of Wisconsin, Madison, the land grant, you know, their university president really articulates this in that way. And so when we think about that, right, the campus is the state is our campus, right? That changes how you approach what you're doing and how. And that has been, you know, I think referenced by many people at different times. And there's something really to be said about that. I've some of my historical research have come across others using some similar phrasing and even imagery that's really striking. How do you take seriously that we are not just doing work for the state, the people, but with the people, right? We're engaging them in some of this process and this, the sense of learning. And again, back to what we were talking earlier of like this knowledge creation, it doesn't only have to be in our labs, right? Some of this is happening in Lewis and Wilmington. And choose your other place, right? All the kind of spots where either conversations are occurring, youth are convening through things like 4-H, or when we want to then translate it to things like IPA and some of the work that's going on in the Biden school, I've spent more time in Legislative Hall, and you know, everybody seems to know the legislative fellows, right? Because they're playing important roles. And so when we think about now the kind of the modern manifestation of engaged learning and experiential learning, like that's showing up in the hallways of a state capitol, but it's also showing up in, like, you know, community partnership sort of work, the sort of thing that we might see happening at a lot of different kind of colleges and universities. But I think the land grants have the added opportunity to think about it as being in more places, in large part because of that larger sense of identity.
And I want to go to something you said earlier, kind of about the fundamental role universities can play and do play relative to democracy. And another book I'll point to is one I recently read, Politics is for Power. If you're not familiar with it, the general thesis is a lot of us are political hobbyists who might root for a party or a platform in the same way we might root for sports teams. And that we've kind of, many of us have forgotten, and some of the systems that used to exist that were more robust to kind of involve us in thinking locally about politics and acting locally and really making a difference in the material lives of folks, that muscle memory of how to make it work and how to participate yourself is not quite there. And I could say, as a political science undergrad, I studied a lot of national issues. A lot of the things I read in that book were news to me about how you might get involved and how you might kind of solve civic issues at your local level. I'm curious, from your perspective, how are you thinking about how to engage students in this civic space?
Yeah, so I believe the book you're referencing is by Hirsch from just a couple of years. Well, now 2020, right? So just a few. And no, it's true, right? I mean, I think especially when we talk about things like political life, kind of civic life, there is this sense of that you're watching things happening from a distance, right? I talk about it a lot. I mean, just one of the partnerships that's flourishing right now, a civil discourse workshop through SNF Ithaca, which I can say a little bit more about here in the Biden School. It's a new initiative around some of these things you're talking about, partnering with IPA and the Biden Institute to have these kind of discussions with our state legislators, right? To talk about this sort of stuff. And why those kinds of efforts are so important is that, you know, seeing this happening in a real tangible way, if people who are closer, it's easy to just look at DC and be like, oh, that's a mess, or like they're fighting or all that sort of thing. And it's more performative, right? Which is why a lot of advocates really say, like, go more local, not even at the state level, right? Like, get really in the weeds of your local, not even maybe city, but like really neighborhoods, that sort of stuff. This is a fundamental kind of notion of what it means to be a citizen. What does it mean to be an engaged and thoughtful citizen, right? As we were kind of referencing a little bit earlier. And so one of the things that's happening now here at the Biden School is we have launched an effort called the SNF Ithaca Initiative. The Stavros Niarchos Foundation has provided some really significant support for us to really imagine what would it look like to have the university play this role for our own students through curricular program, but also a lot of co-curricular learning, right? So having students being placed in different organizations that we make possible. We have these partnerships and things aligning with their interests, right? Their disciplinary interests. And so where they're like, hey, I'm really curious about this sort of question. I'm really interested in technology's role in this sort of stuff. Well, we had one student who went off to and still is working on the development of basically an extension for Chrome for a browser, right? To figure out like what they're looking at and how much and ideologically, where does it go, right? We've got some other students doing, I mean, truly like this fascinating mix. One's working on kind of religious dialogue sort of things, who's a biochemistry major, right? So we have this wonderful mix of not just slotting into certain kind of categories, I guess is the point I want to make there. But one of the other things that's possible through SNF Ithaca is that we are increasingly playing this kind of convening role. We see what we're doing as potentially being a hub for lots of other institutions, particularly public affairs schools, public policy administration and the like, but not exclusive to it. And so last year, we hosted our first national student dialogue, and we brought about 100 students from around the country to spend a long weekend and kind of get introduced to the public policy process. We introduced some issues around civil discourse and what would it look like on their college campuses to take some of this back and say, here's an issue that we know is going on and we want to try to respond to it and address it in these ways now that we've kind of got introduced to some ideas, approaches, models, things like that, right? So to your point earlier, right, there's a moment of like, how do we learn from people we don't have that content yet, so we're going to take it, but we're going to also do, you know, we're going to do the things that we feel are most appropriate. So it's not a toolkit you just pull off and be like, and here's the fix, right? We need to respond to contextual situations. And when we heard it just from a few months ago, we had another convening with the faculty and scholars, the administrators of a lot of these programs, that at some places they've reimagined their first year experience or their orientation to integrate some of this sort of stuff, which is great to hear because we didn't know that prior. And so to hear some of that going on, but at the heart of SNF Ithaca really is this sense of this kind of curricular academic foundation. We have a core class now that it's going to be required for all of our Biden School students called Citizens, Civility, and Change. And so it's all rooted in the sense of, who am I as a citizen? What does it mean to be a citizen? And how particularly do I engage people who are different from me, who have different views, maybe values? Civil discourse, I think, can sometimes get categorized as like, let's just be nice to each other. I think, as you know, from the work that you do in communities, what is maybe more important is we need to be able to kind of engage constructively, right? And so what allows us to do that? And also to really wrestle with some different views of the world and what we ought to do and all those sorts of things. But that's not a reason to not try to engage each other substantively. So that's at the heart of that. And then what comes from that? And so building out that kind of experiential learning too, that is community-based, is a hope that I have for our UD students through this program. I think it's so vital. And this is why I love being at a place like the Biden School, is that we have, since our beginning, this real commitment to kind of this public-facing work, the idea of engaging lots of different communities, right? So we don't have just one strategic partner and everybody falls under that umbrella. Like there's a lot going on, but there's this big, larger sense of purpose, right?
Yeah. Why an SNF Ithaca initiative at the University of Delaware right now?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the easy way, I'll put it this way. I have been really work in the space of civil discourse, kind of dialogue and deliberation for a number of years. And pre-pandemic, particularly, I was really traveling, doing lots of workshops. A couple of the books that I've published are squarely on how we do teaching and learning around this sort of thing. So Deliberative Pedagogy, colleagues and I, we published in 2017. Another book called Creating Space for Democracy came out in 2019. I was literally going to Campus Compact meetings, various associations, kind of speaking to different academic groups, particularly, but all over, people in health and all fields, about where this kind of shows up and why this integrates. And what would happen so often when I would be traveling to these places and you're sitting beside somebody on a plane or whatever, and you start chatting, they're like, oh, what do you do? And it's always that, I mean, you probably have to navigate this too, of like, how much do I want to have a conversation, or what do I want to say on this, you know, on this little airplane for the next hour of my life, potentially? But I would usually be pretty honest person. I would say, you know, that civil discourse, you know, kind of choose your phrasing. And almost uniformly, everybody's like, oh, he's like, you must be so busy. Like, we need it, right? And I think there's some truth there, right? I mean, we were somewhat joking about kind of looking at DC, the dysfunction of Congress, for example. And we've been moving this way for a long time, to the point that, especially when we think about, you know, traditionally aged college students now, they have never existed in a world that is not that, right? They aren't just kind of post-1993 kind of contract with America, kind of Newt Gingrich sort of moment, but they're not even having real, like the real recollections, experience of things like 9/11 that kind of briefly brought people together, right? These sorts of things. They're really existing in this continued polarization. You know, I'm just talking ideologically now, but it also then tracks, as yes, I'm sure you're quite aware, between where you are, where do you live, right? The kind of urban and rural, all these sorts of divides. So the moment that we find ourselves in, the bigger context is this, right? That we are not engaging, right? And in a lot of ways, at least in part, because of some of the wonderful resources that we have, right? We have technology that has allowed us to kind of self-select into certain kind of groups, certain sources of information. I can talk with certain people and I'd rather see them than kind of be out and about in the place that like I physically live, for example. You know, the old book, The Great Good Places, and some other things like that. Where did people show up, right? The pubs and the corner stores or some of the historical research I do, they talk about, particularly in rural places, these old kind of cracker barrels, people would show up at the corner store and like literally lean over the big barrel and talk. You know, some of this carries over today. My father passed away a few years ago, but he used to, all these retirees, men, would show up at McDonald's at some horrendous time in the morning, 5:30, I think was when they showed up. And he knew everything going on in our little town because our former high school teacher was there and all these other sorts of folks, right? And so there's something, not just in like a nostalgic way, but in different times we've had moments of interaction that way. So when we jump to where we are today, it's easier to be, you know, on a phone, right? Or, and I don't want to just dismiss technology or just say that it's bad, tremendous resource, but I think all of this together has really kind of painted a landscape for us that we have to do something with. We need to respond to it in some fashion. So what are we going to do? And so that's partly why I think, why now? Is for this reason, right? We are polarized. We don't have as many, I think, practices and opportunities to engage each other. I mean, even in classrooms, I hear it from students all the time. We do a lot of interaction conversations, like formally kind of structured sort of stuff. And they're like, I've never done anything like this. I'm used to kind of showing up and looking at some slides on a screen and remembering, what do I need to do for a few weeks from now when I either have to write a paper or take a test or things. But you know, when we're convening all sorts of conversations, they were creating some materials themselves, right? Around topics that they really cared about, different kind of policy issues, right? What do they want to do? They had never done that sort of thing. But why is that so important? You know, it's like anything. It's kind of building up a civic muscle, right? We need to exercise to foster that. And I think there's a chance for us to do that in classrooms, but I think there's a chance for us to do it, you know, our National Student Dialogue, right? Over an extended weekend, right? When you get really deep into it and you leave and you're saying, oh my gosh, I've got some real practical things to do. But also for others, right? To have kind of these internships, these opportunities to really think about these questions in a particular situation that they say, oh yes, and this is how this really applies here. And not just some abstract way of like, oh, we ought to be better people. Oh, we ought to talk to each other. Well, you know what? No kidding. But how do we do that? That's where I think for me, and I think us collectively here at the Biden School, thinking about this, why something that focuses on things like civil discourse and civic engagement, and increasingly now thinking about this all within the kind of mediated public square, right? Our shared life, is that fundamentally it's about being a democratic citizen. We can be citizens of all sorts of entities and kind of states, things like that. But if we really want to value democracy, kind of liberal democracy, we need to be able to not just engage, but really thrive as people who come from different backgrounds and experiences and views and kind of deep commitments. We need to be able to do that, not just in some big picture abstract way, but in really tangible, like we are on this campus. We are in this city. We are in this place. And at least for a time, right? Maybe not forever and always, right? There's always this kind of fluidity, especially college students. But when we think about communities, when we think about a state, right? There, to your point earlier, right? We're going to be here. So we have a vested interest. And I think this is an opportunity. If we do this work well, and we're on the front end of this, but I think if we do this work well, there is an opportunity for us to really help foster, cultivate, and sustain these kind of conversations and interactions that have, I think, positive lasting effects. And when they have to be kind of wrestled with and talked about and thought about again, we can show back up. One, because we're still here. We're going to be here. And we also did it in a way that even if the outcome wasn't exactly what some folks wanted, if the process was fair and inclusive and engaging, all these sorts of things, people were more willing to participate down the line. that's the heart of deliberative democracy, right? Let people make some ideas and talk about it and make some provisional decisions and recognize that that might not always be the case. But you know what? That's life, right? We work with the information and the context we have, and we go forward from there. And one of my hopes here is that we weave this into what it means to be the Biden School of Public Policy and Administration at the university, that this core engaged kind of citizen identity is here, but then we also demonstrate that to everybody else on this campus and beyond.
Well, I look forward to being here with you for the years to come and, witnessing and being part of kind of that need to kind of exercise the civic muscle, as you put it, over time. And I really appreciate you being here with me today, Tim, and thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, this is wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening today. To learn more about Tim Schaefer's work through the Biden School and the SNF Ithaca Initiative, visit bidenschool.udel.edu. For more information on the Institute for Public Administration, visit ipa.udel.edu. If you enjoyed this episode, look for past and future episodes of First State Insights wherever you get podcasts. I hope you'll tune in again soon. Take care.